You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of October 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, from Ottawa to Tunisia to Nigeria to Juba, we'll review the day's top news with Ivor Gaber and Martin Plout. We'll also visit the Science Museum's new exhibit devoted to the information age.
We're very, very lucky that we have the next computer, the actual computer which Sir Tim Berners-Lee used to design the World Wide Web. And it has a lovely sticker on it that says, "This machine is a server. Do not power it down." So if you turned that machine off at the time, you would have turned off the World Wide Web, something that's inconceivable to us today.
Our man in Madrid is at the awards ceremony for Spain's version of the Nobel Prize. He tells us about a previous winner, Woody Allen.
Well, he actually made a very funny comment. He said, "I don't really deserve this award, but I also have diabetes and I don't really deserve that either." So he had the whole audience laughing. Even the Queen was chuckling up in her booth.
Later in the show,
they come from a dying world. They drift through the universe, pushed on by the solar winds. They adapt and they survive.
The week's best in film with the critic and Midori House regular Tim Robey. That's all coming up right now on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24. A typically action-packed 60 minutes, ahead of which Barney Burnham has the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Seven employees of the Canadian consulate in Istanbul have been taken to hospital after coming into contact with a suspicious package containing yellow powder. One staff member came directly into contact with the package, while six others had indirect exposure. Similar packages were also sent to the German and Belgian consulates in Istanbul. The Turkish authorities have launched an investigation. A doctor in New York City has tested positive for Ebola, the fourth case to be diagnosed in the US. He just returned to the US after treating patients in Guinea. Two friends and the doctor's fiancé have been quarantined as a precaution. The World Health Organization says a million doses of a vaccine will be produced by the end of next year. WHO Assistant Director General for Health Systems and Innovation, Marie Polchini, said experimental Ebola vaccine trials could begin in affected countries as early as December this year.
It was well known now to all participants that phase one clinical trials of the two most advanced vaccines have started, and that results from these trials will be available in December 2014. So, of course, this will be preliminary result. At least five more vaccines are following up closely and will be in the clinic in the first month of 2015.
European leaders say a deal struck on cutting greenhouse gases by 2030 is a crucial step forward for Europe. After lengthy talks, an overall target was agreed for the 28-nation bloc to cut its carbon emissions in 2030 by at least 40% from levels in the benchmark year of 1990. Talks in Brussels stretched into the small hours of Friday as Poland pushed for concessions from the measures to protect its coal industry. Michael Jacobs from the London School of Economics believes it's a significant agreement.
This is important not just in Europe, but for the rest of the world, because the rest of the world is looking at Europe and saying, well, you know, they've started to do renewable energy and energy efficiency and so on over the last few years, but are they going to continue this? And this agreement, I think, does say, yes, Europe will continue on this path. It sees prosperity as something that is achieved by going lower carbon, by having cleaner energy and so on.
British Prime Minister David Cameron has challenged a demand from the European Union for an additional €2.1 billion payment into the EU budget. The demand comes after a revision of economic statistics. The Netherlands, Italy, Greece and Cyprus also have to pay more in the next few weeks, while the likes of Germany and France get a rebate. European Commission President José Manuel Barroso insists the system is fair.
These corrections are made every year. In some years, the net effect will be to increase a member state's contribution. That is the case for the UK, the Netherlands and some others this year. In other cases, the net effect will be to reduce the contribution. This was the case for the UK, for instance, in 2008. I understand the concerns that it has raised in London, but sometimes these decisions happen.
A Moscow court has arrested four more people in connection with the fatal crash at Vnukovo Airport that killed Christophe de Margerie, the chief executive of the French oil major Total. The airport's chief service engineer and flight dispatcher will remain in jail until their scheduled court hearing on December the 21st. The female trainee and the head of flights have been put under house arrest. The driver of the snowplow involved in the crash was arrested on Thursday. The airport's chief executive and his deputy have resigned over the crash. Italy's top court has upheld an appeal by the fashion designers Domenico Dolce and Stefano Gabbana against a conviction for tax evasion. Last year, they were sentenced to 20 months imprisonment after a lower court found them guilty of failing to declare €1 billion of income. In May, the verdict was upheld, but the penalty was reduced to an 18-month suspended sentence. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Barney. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. We will be back right after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Ut London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Midori House coming up for 18.07 in London, which will be 18... No, it'll be 13.07 in New York. Wouldn't be the same time in both cities. That would be mad. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio are journalist and journalism professor Ivor Gaber and Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Welcome both. We will start in Canada, a country usually a comfortable distance from global news headlines, now coming to terms with a bizarre week in which, in apparently unrelated incidents, two Canadian soldiers were murdered on Canadian soil by Canadian citizens, both of them converts to Islam. Prime Minister Stephen Harper has vowed that the attacks will prompt Canada to redouble, as he put it, efforts to thwart terrorism at home and fight it abroad. Ivor, I'll ask you first, is this just the sort of stuff a prime minister of anywhere is expected to say in these circumstances, or does he mean something specific by it?
Well, the obvious answer is I don't know what he means, but I do think when you have something like that happened in Ottawa a couple of days ago, so traumatic, it is the job of the Prime Minister or the President, depending, to try and reassure, pull together lessons that move forward in a sense. I mean, there's a PR job, and I don't say that flippantly, an important PR job to be done.
Certainly.
Particularly, as you say, because Canada is not used to, I mean, nobody gets used to it, but, even the 7/7 bombings in London hit a city that was used to bombings from the IRA days. Ottawa, I don't know if there's ever been a terrorist incident in Ottawa before, but certainly I think whatever he meant, it was important he said something that gave the sense of being in control and moving forward.
I mean, it's certainly an exceptional event in Ottawa. Canada, going back to the 60s and 70s, had a bit of a history with the FLQ, the Front Liberation Quebec. Was it FQL or FLQ? I think it was FLQ. But Martin, what have you made of how Canada both, I guess, reported the story and coped with the fact of the story versus how the US or the UK or other countries might have done it? There seemed to be a certain calmness and stolidity about it, and an absence, I noted, in the Canadian media of people saying, well, we brought it on ourselves, really.
Well, yes, I particularly like the fact that the Prime Minister hid in a broom cupboard, as far as I can see.
And can I say MPs were reported to be sharpening broomsticks to fend off the terrorists?
It all sounded very sort of do-it-yourself kind of security. I mean, you look, you know, when you if you compare this with the Canadian Parliament with, say, the Knesset, you know, you cannot get into the Knesset with anything, not even a pin. I mean, you are searched to your underwear practically in order to make sure once you get in, you can do anything you like. The Israeli security forces don't give a damn how rude you are to their MPs. But I mean, you know, Canada is clearly not in that kind of class. You know, they are, you know, a nation which has, as you say, a great stability, and they're not used to these kind of, shall we say, awkward incidences. But I mean, there doesn't seem to have been any. I haven't seen any reported attacks on Muslims or on minorities. So I suppose they seem to be taking it in their stride at the moment.
I mean, you're quite right in that Canada's Parliament building is famously very, very open in a way that obviously somewhere like the Knesset wouldn't be, and with good reason. Although my own personal favourite memory on that score is visiting the US Embassy in Beirut about 3 weeks after September 11th. They disassembled my biro before I was allowed in to speak to the ambassador, thereby, as I did try to point out, rendering it entirely useless. But, I mean, Ivor, do you think that a country like Canada, I guess, can retain the nerve to remain Canada? Is there a tendency for politicians, and you're quite right in saying that there is an important PR job to do, but is there a tendency to overreact?
Well, don't forget, I mean, we're talking about Canada as if it's this quiet little backwater. Canada has been split between English and French speakers for many, many years. And that remains, I won't say a wound, but it certainly remains a deep mark across Canada. So this is not a totally society at ease with itself. We're not talking about a sort of Caribbean, a Tahitian island where all of a sudden something happens. And they do live next door to a noisy neighbour. They do live next door to a country which actually might not suffer much terrorism, but is certainly very terrorism aware. And when you cross your, I can't better your story on the biro, but crossing from the Canadian to the US border is not a simple operation. Cars are searched, mirrors under cars. So Canada has been terrorism aware, but the question that I'm pondering, and this has been raised, is it a good idea? Both of the gunmen who were killed in the last few days were denied passports. And presume to go to, and on the assumption they're going to Syria. And although we obviously don't know their mindset, you know, it's a pretty good idea. They thought, well, if I can't go to Syria, I'm going to cause a bit of mayhem here. Is it sensible to be denying would-be terrorist passports? Should it not be better to let them go and to monitor them and maybe deal with them and come back? Because the obvious implication, if you deny them, is what happened in Ottawa.
Or you could be incredibly cynical, let them go and then cancel their passports while they're away so they can't come back.
But and just expect them to die.
Yes, unfortunately, they do occasionally have the inconvenient habit of not doing that. I mean, Martin, what do you think? Is that, one, a sensible precaution? And two, is it the sort of thing any democracy should be doing?
Well, I think one of the big problems is that we assume that politicians actually can do something, and we expect them to do something about practically everything. And frankly, about almost everything, they can do nothing. So, you know, I mean, I don't know if you see, but every time when these terrible things happened where the Islamic State slit the throat of various Westerners, you know, both in America and in the UK, they threatened, oh, we will find them, we will track them down, we will never give up. In fact, there's no history of us ever managing to track down these people. So these statements are required. It's what you need to do to be a prime minister. But, you know, I remember when, you know, I was a kid growing up in South Africa. You know, if you were a brave young man, you left the country and joined the ANC. So there's a lot of testosterone in young men. They want to go off and do something and be something and make their mark. This is one way of doing it. These young men are doing this. It's not very different, I don't think.
Well, let's look now at Tunisia, which is voting in parliamentary elections this Sunday. Now, with due acknowledgement that everything is relative, Tunisia has been regarded as the success, in inverted commas, story of the Arab Spring, although obviously Egypt, Libya and Syria are low bars to get over. Already, however, the vote has not been trouble-free. A policeman was killed yesterday and several others injured in a shootout with Islamists on the outskirts of Tunis. Martin, I'll ask you first, how hopeful or otherwise should we, and indeed more importantly the people of Tunisia, be about this election?
Well, I hope it goes well. You know, they deserve it more than practically anyone else does. They've gone about it in what seems like a pretty solid way. But I mean, they are up against it. They have a terrible neighbourhood. You've got Mali below. You've got the Libyans on the one side. You've got Algerians on the other. You have gun-running cartels who mix Islamism with drugs. And, you know, it is a toxic mix. Now, can you really build a solid democracy in that kind of environment when you don't have much of a history of it? I wonder. But I wish them every success.
Hey. Well, I was just going to say, I was in Tunisia last year and the year before working with Tunisian journalists. There was admittedly, I didn't have too many Salafis on my course, but there was a real passion to make it work. There was a real passion. And it's interesting, in Ada, the Muslim support the Muslim-orientated political party has seemingly learnt the lessons of the Muslim Brotherhood in Cairo. They have said they've got to go, you know, they realise that they have to work with the secularist parties. They're not contesting the presidential election. So I think the signs are better than, well, anywhere else in the Arab world is, as you say, a low bar. But I'm relatively confident. The Tunisian people in general had a relatively high educational standard. And I just have the feeling when I've visited there that it's got a long way to go before it collapses, so to speak.
The Ennahda party you mentioned there, they do seem very much the kind of, if you're going to have an Islamist party, they're probably the kind of Islamist party you want. They have been relatively reasonable. And you're quite right. They do seem to have looked at what the Muslim Brotherhood did in Egypt and thought, yeah, let's not do any of that.
I interviewed the then leader of the Ennahda party when I was there a couple of years ago. That was because he subsequently stepped down. But we, halfway through the interview, he stopped and said something in Arabic, and I heard the words Hemel Hempstead, because there is no Arabic for Hemel Hempstead.
And amazing.
My first job was as a reporter in Hemel Hempstead, so I suddenly said, "What?" And he told me that until he became Prime Minister, he'd been living in Hemel Hempstead, and we then spent 10 minutes a bit nostalgic about this new town in Hertfordshire in England. And it just reminded me that actually some of these people weren't dyed-in-the-wool underground Muslim Brotherhood workers. They had come in after the fall of the dictatorships and perhaps hopefully brought some ideas about democracy with them.
I once spent a journalistic assignment in Tunisia. This was pre-revolution, being followed around by a surreally hapless secret policeman who waxed nostalgic at every opportunity for the year he spent in Stockton-on-Tees. it does take all sorts. One interesting thing that some senior figures in Ennahda have been saying, though, and Martin, you sort of referred there when we were talking about Ottawa to sort of testosterone-fueled, somewhat foolish young men wanting to go and fight overseas in some capacity. Tunisia, weirdly, has been the single greatest contributor, according to some reports, of foreign volunteers to ISIS, as many as 3,000 of them. And one senior figure from the Ennahda party said, as he put it, they've overestimated the capacity for democracy to tame extremism. Does he have a point there?
Well, I think he does. But then, you know, you have to ask yourself, why in the Arab world is democracy so thin? And without sounding like an old-fashioned Marxist, I think it comes back down to class issues. It genuinely does. Because at the end of the day, you have basically mostly extractive industries across the Arab world, or you have a peasantry and, farming. You have no basic working class and middle class that is well entrenched and requires a deep set of social relationships and legal relationships, which is what democracy is built on, certainly in Britain and in the rest of Western Europe. That is how this peculiar thing called democracy came about. It was because you needed these set of legal relationships in order to hold your businesses together. And that was why people were prepared to sit down and give up things that they didn't wish to give up, because it was a legal relationship. It is very, very peculiar. And there just is no similar relationship across the Arab world because there is a very thin class base to it. And I mean, it's a very crude way of looking at it, but I think there's some truth to it.
It reminds me, Martin's mentioning the relationship between democracy and rule of law, essentially. There's a Peruvian economist whose name just escapes me for the moment, who reckons there is a direct correlation between what we would define as democracy and how long it takes to get a new business registered. Because in non-democracies, it can take years as you pay the bribe.
And that's right, literally.
In democracies, it's bump, bump, bump. And Soto, and he says getting the rule of law established is the first prerequisite for democracy. But of course, how do you do that?
Yeah.
It's an interesting point, but it is an unfashionable one to make. We sort of had this situation, especially, I guess, around the invasion of Iraq in 2003, this idea that democracy would cure everything by itself, that it was a panacea for everything. And having reported from a few places where a certain measure of nation building was in progress, I've heard so many times from extremely senior figures, yeah, it doesn't work like that. You need the rule of law and you need it imposed quite uncompromisingly at first, and then they've then followed that up by saying, but by the way, you absolutely cannot quote me on that, because you cannot say that out loud.
But the rule of law cannot be imposed. That's the point. It needs to grow out of something, And that something was the business relationship that grew up in the 18th and 19th century in Europe. It was very peculiar. That's what I'm trying to say. And out of that relationship, you needed to be able to say to somebody, I know that I may lose this, but I will go to court and we will accept the judgment. And if you go down to the commercial court just off the Strand here in London, you will see 5, 6, 7 floors of people coming to London specifically to fight each other only in court because they know they can't bribe the judges here. So they will come from across the world and they pay fortunes to do it, and Britain makes an absolute killing out of it. It's a huge commercial venture. But this is only because this strange thing called a legal system exists here and you cannot bribe a judge.
Well, on that happy thought, we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Ivor Gaber and Martin Platt. When we return, we will be asking if Boko Haram are indeed stoppable, and we'll ask if peace is on the horizon at last in South Sudan.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Midori House and Monocle 24. We're coming up for 1822 in London. Still with me are Ivor Gaber and Martin Plout. Now, earlier this week, a glimmer of hope appeared, or appeared to appear, in the grim saga of Boko Haram, the Nigerian Islamist movement who acquired global infamy earlier this year with a mass kidnapping of more than 200 schoolgirls. Word was that a ceasefire had been agreed, paving the way for a possible return of the hostages. It later emerged that, instead, Boko Haram had seized at least 25 more women and girls in Adamawa State in Nigeria's northeast. Martin, I'll ask you first. I guess the obvious question is how coherent or monolithic an organisation is Boko Haram, or has it become, say, akin to Al-Qaeda, sort of an idea which local franchises kind of interpret as they wish?
I think it's both. I think there are elements which are local, but it does have a greater coherence than you suggest. I mean, the big difficulty is, and always has been, the relationship between Boko Haram and certain elements within the Nigerian political establishment in the north, who are have been keen to use Boko Haram against the president, because he is a southerner. And would you, in the run-up to next year's elections, wish to give a southern president the biggest present you could, which is the release of these 200 girls? I think not. So they will probably hold out for quite some time. But one could be wrong. I mean, maybe this is just a glitch. Maybe things are coming. But I think that the North-South tensions, in of which there are only one element in Nigeria, are at least as much to do with what's going on in the north and Boko Haram than anything else.
Ivor Gaber, there's some suggestion, as I understand, a very confused story, that Chad has been the intermediary in a peace agreement between, or a ceasefire at least, between Nigerian authorities and Boko Haram. Chad not normally known as a kind of like model of governmental best practice.
Yeah, these reports have been puzzling. Certainly when I've been reading the Nigerian media, they gave short shrift to these negotiations very early on. Boko Haram are not based in Chad. If the Cameroon is there, is where they're hiding. Well, they don't need to hide because they control large swathes of territory. The so-called negotiator was unknown to the Nigerian media that I was reading, and they were suggesting the whole thing was a stunt by the ruling party. As Martin was saying, the Boko Haram situation is very complex. On one level, it is certainly Islamicist Al-Qaeda in the Sahara and so forth. But behind it lies these deep and profound tensions between a nation that's never really been at one with itself. Extreme poverty in the north. Some of the poorest, the great paradox of Nigeria, it has the most people living below the poverty line of any country in Africa and the most number of millionaires. It is the classic divided society and it is just boiling over. And I've worked in Nigeria and found it an uncomfortable place because one is so aware of these tensions. And just a final note, which sounded bizarre, and as you might recall, when the girls from Chibok or their parents went to protest in Abuja to say, bring back our girls, the president's wife, who is no mean politician in her own right, and I emphasise the word mean, set the riot police on them because she said, you're agents of the APC, the opposition party. I mean, it's fearful, the idea that you've had your girl kidnapped and you're then just accused of being a front for another party. So the whole situation is grim, and I wish I could see a light on the end of the horizon, except to say there are elections in 2015, as you mentioned, and maybe they will resolve something or other, watch this space, but with not a great deal of optimism.
And final thought on this story, Martin. I mean, the Nigerian government obviously has been very keen to portray Boko Haram as the sort of the ISIS of West Africa. But is that fair? Is there, unpleasant though Boko Haram obviously are, is there somewhere beneath that unpleasantness a coherent political agenda that could be the basis for negotiations?
Difficult, I think. I mean, they reject the entire relationship with the, you know, with the modern world. And, you know, how do you negotiate in those circumstances? But, you know, anything is possible in Nigeria. It's such a strange place. It is certainly possible that some of the elites in the north will finally find a way around this. I mean, the Emir Kano was the central bank governor and is an immensely wise and clever man. And, you know, perhaps he'll find a way eventually around this problem, because he does have, I mean, I don't know what you think, Ivor, but he does, in my view, have a lot of legitimacy still.
He does, but he was sacked by the government. I mean, he is seen as an opposition figure. He was actually seen to be getting grips with the worst of Nigeria's corruption and was moved out. So I don't think he's seen by the government in the south as a figure who can unite the country. But, you know, the northerners are pinning their hopes on General Buhari. But, you know, he's been around the course so many times. There are no new political initiatives, although, you know, the Nigerian people themselves, just to generalise, have enormous sympathy for, are desperately looking for a way forward, but it's not obvious what it should be.
Okay, well, we need to look finally and unfortunately briefly a little further south in Africa to South Sudan. This week, peace talks in Arusha in Tanzania have offered the hope of a beginning to the end, of an end rather, to the violence which has consumed pretty much South Sudan's entire existence. Martin Plaut, previous deals have come and they have gone. Is there any reason to be more optimistic about this one?
Yes, cautiously. Partly because the Tanzanian ruling party, the ANC, to its great credit, have been put a huge muscle behind this. The Americans, the Brits, everybody is pushing for it. And because the people in South Sudan themselves want it. I mean, Salva Kiir and Riek Machar both were there, plus the third group, very importantly, of the people who were locked up but are in neither camp. Everyone was there, everyone put their names to it, and the regional grouping IGAD has also supported it. So I'm cautiously hopeful. One shouldn't hold one's breath, but it is a possible glimmer.
And I have a question for Martin. Allegedly, women in South Sudan have threatened to go on a sex strike unless there is a resolution. Is this the explanation for why it's all looking good?
I don't think it is, but after all, it was tried in Colombia as well, you know.
Liberia as well in 2003.
Absolutely.
There is precedent for it, and, you know, peace of a sort was achieved in both countries.
Absolutely right.
Ivor, do you think that aside, did you share Martin's optimism just finally?
Well, I haven't visited South Sudan, but I spent quite a lot of time in North Uganda, which borders on it, and it is an area of constant instability. There's tribal movements. Lord's Resistance Army is still around, not exactly in that area. So I bow to Martin's great expertise in this area. I've never heard him so positive about South Sudan in before. So I think
cautiously
optimistic.
He's emphasising cautiously.
So, you know, if he says it, I'll go with it.
We will have to leave it there. On that cautiously optimistic note, Ivor Gaber and Martin Plout, thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And plenty more still to come in the second half of today's show. We'll be speaking to our man in Montreal reviewing the latest film releases. And here in London, we will visit the Science Museum's new exhibition devoted to the information age. Ahead of all that, however, Barney Burnham has the headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. Seven employees at the Canadian consulate in Istanbul have been taken to hospital after coming into contact with a suspicious package containing yellow powder. Similar packages were sent to the German and Belgian consulates. A doctor in New York City has tested positive for Ebola, the fourth case to be diagnosed in the US. He just returned after treating patients in Guinea. European leaders say a deal struck on cutting greenhouse gases by 2030 is a crucial step forward for Europe. The 28-nation bloc has agreed to cut emissions by at least 40% from levels in the benchmark year of 1990. The British Prime Minister David Cameron has challenged a demand from the European Union for an additional €2.1 billion payment into the EU budget. He says he won't pay. A Moscow court has arrested four more people in connection with the fatal crash at Vnukovo Airport that killed Christophe de Margerie, the chief executive of the French oil company Total. And Italy's top court has upheld an appeal by the fashion designers Domenico Dolce and Stefano Gabbana against a conviction for tax evasion. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Barney. Welcome back to Midori House, live on Monocle 24. It's 21:31 in Moscow, 18:31 here in London, 14:31 in Rio. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, who is in none of those places. Today we're going to Montreal, where we are awaited by our correspondent, Steve Bodson. Steve, obviously it has been a huge and bizarre news week in Canada, which started with an attack in a small town south of Montreal on Monday. I'm really hard to know where to start asking. How are people in Montreal sort of processing what's happened?
Well, on the street, I'd say everyday folks are not really freaking out. It's been pretty much a keep calm, carry on kind of approach here in the city, with the exception, of course, of if you go to major public buildings, especially in the aftermath of the attack on Parliament on Wednesday. Public buildings here in Montreal do have more security now, a few more police, and even major public gatherings, big art shows and so forth, are seeing a little bit more police than we're usually accustomed to seeing here.
Okay, well, on the subject of the police, many of them are reporting for work in non-regulation uniform, as I understand it.
Yeah, this has been a kind of an ongoing thing here in Montreal, and in fact, with these attacks, the mayor has put out a call to the police to put their regular trousers back on, and that's because the police union has been protesting a proposed change to their pensions, and since they can't really go on strike or just go walk a picket line all day, they have been protesting by wearing non-regulation trousers. A lot of them are wearing camouflage, not just gray camouflage or green, but fluorescent pink or purple. And so really standing out, some other people wear bright red trousers. So this has been, at first I just thought that Montreal police were kind of punk rock, but as it turns out now, this is actually a political protest. And it's, the mayor is not happy about it. Certainly makes them look less professional, but it's apparently doing its job of getting under his skin.
And how is public sympathy trending on this one way or the other? And has it changed since the attacks earlier this week? You said the mayor suggested it might be appropriate for the police to sort of dress up properly. Do the public buy that?
I doubt that that's going to really change the lines where this is broken down. Certainly, the more kind of pro-union, pro-labor side of the public supports the police in this. This is a retroactive pay cut, essentially, by telling them they can that they should lose some of the pensions they were promised years ago. And the people who are a little bit more fiscally conservative, who are more worried about budget shortfalls and so forth, are probably going to keep telling the police that this is the price of being a public employee and put your trousers back on. But no, I don't think that these attacks are having a huge effect on that. Certainly, that one thing that where they are having an effect is giving Canadians on the ground a little bit more direct sympathy for soldiers, because certainly the Canadian forces, while present in the country, are not generally seen as kind of under fire here in Canada. Having two soldiers killed within a week by really kind of lone attackers, as far as we can tell, but people who are sympathizing with a you know, this jihadist movement in the Middle East, that's definitely given people a little bit more sympathy and a little bit more, I'd say, emotional connection with the Canadian forces.
Okay, I wanted to ask about another story, which will seem fairly counterintuitive to a lot of people, which is a possible plan to deprive Montreal citizens of a means of making themselves warm.
Oh, right. Yes, you're talking about the wood stoves.
Indeed.
Yeah, the city is planning to ban wood stoves to improve air quality. This is definitely not thrilling for people, especially since there aren't that many wood stoves. The island of Montreal has something like 1.5 million people, and there are apparently about 80,000 wood stoves. So it's not like it's the most common method of heating. And I think that it's widely seen as carbon neutral and in some ways good for the long-term environment. But sure, when you have a collection of them in one place, you do start to see kind of a blue haze on the street. This is something that we really see in some of the more commercial areas, not from residential wood stoves, but from businesses making bagels and making Portuguese chicken, two specialties in Montreal, and both of which are generally cooked over flaming embers. So it's I'm curious to see how the city decides to respond to these restaurants and bakeries that currently use wood, because it looks to me like that's a bigger source of smoke, and it's also an important cultural tradition.
Steve Bodson in Montreal, thank you as ever for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism, at Monocle 24 we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world. Monocle 24 is your 24-hour-a-day international radio service. Based in the heart of London, with contributions from our bureau in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York, Toronto and Zurich, and reporters in more than 30 countries, we broadcast a mix of news, discussion, features, reportage, reviews, music and more. From retail to travel, food to urbanism, business to film, Monocle 24 has it covered.
One of the things that I would like to allude to, which is very much the kind of thing that you're doing here, is you're having this kind of discussion. But the discussion that needs to take place, where the forward thinking needs to come from, is from the brains trusts and the think tanks, and they're not doing it.
To call it an international conference, that's difficult in itself. The really difficult thing is then to start to implement the conclusions.
I was actually the last correspondent to send dispatches by carrier pigeon. It's not something I'm proud of.
There are two kind of games, the games that uses the city and the other kinds, the city that uses the games.
Plus, our carefully curated playlist is the soundtrack to your day, stretching from Stockholm to Sydney, Brooklyn to Bogota.
It was like entering the gates of heaven.
You can hear us live at monocle.com, catch up with anything you may have missed on our time shift player, download our bespoke app for your smartphone, and hear it all on iTunes. I like the sense that you just have no idea where it's going to go.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Now, when the code for the World Wide Web was first written by computer scientist Tim Berners-Lee, he didn't imagine the impact it would have on our lives and the way we access information. Or maybe he did. He's a clever bloke. The Science Museum in London has now dedicated a new permanent gallery called Information Age. It was opened today by Queen Elizabeth II. Monocle met the curator, Tilly Blythe.
Information Age is a brand new permanent gallery at the Science Museum. It looks at the last 200 years of information and communication technologies. For us, we really wanted to invite visitors to think about the devices that they use every day, like telephones, mobile phones, televisions, computers, but to actually think beyond the device and start to think about the infrastructure that makes all of that connected world possible. This gallery contains over 800 objects, so it's a vast permanent gallery, really big space, over 2,500 square metres. So it was quite a challenge when we were thinking about how to curate the exhibition, and we came up with the idea of having six networks. They're kind of technological networks, but they're also networks of people and of places. So the six networks that we've looked at are the earliest one, which we call the cable, which is about electric telegraphy. Then there's a section called the broadcast that looks at radio and television. Then there's a section called the exchange that looks at telephony. Then the section behind us is called the constellation, and that looks at satellite communications. And then there's a section called the web, so that looks at computer networks. And then finally, the most contemporary section, the section called the cell, that looks at mobile data and cellular voice networks. This is 2LO, it's the BBC's first radio transmitter. So from 1922, this sent out the BBC's first radio programmes across London, and it sent them from a place called Marconi House in the Strand in the centre of London. So it's really the thing that enables radio to become entertainment and news. You know, it starts to send out those types of programmes rather than just voice transmissions. It's a gorgeous object, isn't it? It's beautiful glass valves, these copper coils, which are the inductors, and then the capacitors behind. It's very, very homemade. You know, it's very hand-built. And it's just the thing that allows the signal to be transmitted out. We've created an installation that has some of the earliest radio recordings from the BBC, so the kinds of programmes that you would have heard transmitted by 2LO.
I have never wanted to withhold anything, but until now, it has not been constitutionally possible for me to speak.
So we're fantastically lucky that the Queen has come to open the gallery. Obviously, she knows what happened during the coronation. She was there. But it was a really momentous moment for us to be able to play her some of the oral histories that were actually people remembering what it was like to watch television for the first time on that incredible day. So hopefully this was a very touching moment for her as well, to realise the impact that that had on people in Britain.
Her Majesty goes to dedicate herself to her people. Queen and mother of the greatest family of nations on earth.
So this was a point that, you know, it's a massive reason for buying a television. Many people didn't have a television, but when they knew the coronation was going to be broadcast, they went out and bought them. And so there was about 20 people per set that were crowded round watching television for the first time. So, you know, it was very, very busy in those households, all trying to get a glimpse of the Queen on this special day. We're very, very lucky that we have the next computer, the actual computer which Sir Tim Berners-Lee used to design the World Wide Web. So this is the machine that he had at CERN when he was actually thinking about how you might connect information and categorize information. So yeah, it's the actual machine, and it has a lovely sticker on it that says, "This machine is a server. Do not power it down." So if you turned that machine off at the time, you would have turned off the World Wide Web, something that's inconceivable to us today. I think the interesting thing is, you know, it is so interconnected, but actually many of our predecessors had interconnected worlds. You know, the fact that the telegraph cable stems from the 1830s, you know, it was incredible that actually our predecessors lived through a similar period of change where they could send messages far more quickly than they had previously been able to. To me, what's very interesting is that so much of the infrastructure is actually quite hidden from us. So we're standing by this base station. This is a vast cactus, you know, it holds a mobile phone base station within it. So you wouldn't actually know that you were standing next to a piece of technology from a mobile phone, you know, the thing that enabled your connected life to exist, because it's hidden from you. It's disguised as a cactus, and you'll find trees that are actually mobile phone base stations as well. So many of these things, you know, really enable us all to talk to each other, but you don't realise they're there and surrounding us all the time.
That was Tilly Blythe, curator of the new Information Age Gallery at the Science Museum here in London. And it's just gone 18:45 here in London. Now, many countries and other entities have awards which try to compete with the world's most famous, the Nobel. Spain is no different. The Prince of Asturias Awards, as they're known, are handed out annually, like the Nobel. And also, like the Nobel, they're awarded for achievements in a variety of pursuits, from the humanities to science. We sent Monocle's man in Madrid, Liam Aldous, to Oviedo in northern Spain, where the awards are being distributed tonight. A bit earlier, Liam spoke to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli.
So I've just flown into Oviedo this afternoon for the Prince of Asturias Awards. It's the 34th edition. It was actually an event basically made to cultivate the leadership skills of the Crown Prince Felipe. Long ago, he actually gave us his first speech ever at this event when he was 13 years old. But this year we're in a bit of a quandary, because the Prince of Asturias is now the King of Spain. So they've been a bit slow to change the name, but I have been told that next year they're going to change the name's event to the Princess of Asturias Award. So basically, to give you an idea of what it's about, it's basically Spain's Nobel Prize. So they have awards they give to people from all over the world for distinct categories such as the arts, sport, social cohesion, science, and there's been big names that have received awards over the years. Leonard Collins received an award, the International Space Station, even Woody Allen actually received an award, and he came and accepted the award in person, which is a big rarity, as you probably know.
That must have been a pretty awkward acceptance.
Well, he actually made a very funny comment. He said, I don't really deserve this award, but I also have diabetes, and I don't really deserve that either. So he had the whole audience laughing. Even the Queen was chuckling up in her booth.
Amazing. I know the whole town's involved, too, in the ceremonies. What's the atmosphere like?
It's actually really beautiful up here. The whole town comes out in traditional dress, all playing the bagpipes and various traditional musical instruments. A lot of people don't realize, but in the north of Spain, they've got a big Gaelic kind of influence. So yeah, they play the bagpipes up here. There's some playing in the background. You probably can't hear them, though. They're far away. But the good thing about this event is that it's not just the award ceremony today. It's the whole week leading up to it. The awardees are actually invited here to give seminars, and there's all these cultural events, and the whole town gets involved. So this little kind of village has big names come to their doorstep. Even people like Jane Goodall's been here before. I mentioned Leonard Cohen, but yeah, like big names that would never usually come here, and they get to have front row and center in their town.
I know there was a bit of controversy earlier today. Frank Gehry stuck his finger up at a journalist. Tell us what happened there.
Grumpy Frank Gehry, yeah. He was at a press conference, and the first question he was asked was about the architecture of spectacle, and he basically just stuck his finger up at the journalist, and everyone was a bit in shock. There was an awkward silence, and then he kind of calmed down and just said he's just sick of those questions, and he said that 98% of the things built today are basically crap, and the few people that make good, special buildings are always plagued with these questions. So eventually he apologized and said, I'm just grumpy because I've flown all this way here. He is 85 as well. He's probably just sick and tired of those questions. He's been getting them his whole life. I'm sure he'll get a big round of applause today when the awards are handed out a little bit later on.
And I know you've been traveling all day. You were at Midori House yesterday. You woke up super early to get there. You've been traveling. But what's on the agenda for later today? What do you have planned?
Well, so I'm going to go to the award ceremony in this beautiful theatre in Oviedo. All the royal circle will be there. There's actually a big noisy protest just outside the theatre. So Republicans have showed up. They were here last year as well, and we couldn't actually hear them once we got inside, but there seem to be more this year. I don't know what's going on, but my particular program will involve going to this award ceremony. It's quite beautiful. The king will give a keynote speech as well. This is one of his big speeches of the year. He'll talk about getting Spaniards to be optimistic again. I'm sure he always has a positive message on this day. And then later there's a bit of a party, and then I'll fly back to Madrid. Very tired, Danny. I'm not as grumpy as Frank Gehry, but I'm still very tired.
And that was Monocle's hard-working Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldous, there talking to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. And we are veritably hurtling towards the end of today's show, which means it's time for our daily arts review. It being Friday, we talk film. I think it works like that. I forget. I think we talked film last Friday, so I'm assuming that's a thing. Anyway, joining me once again is Tim Robey, film critic with the Daily Telegraph and a regular here in this spot on Midori House. First of all, we have Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence together again. Are they becoming, this is in Serena, this film, are they turning into the whole Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn thing or not quite?
I guess that's the idea. The weird
it does
thing,
appear to be an idea someone has.
This is the idea. The weird thing with this film is that it's quite old. They shot it 2 years ago. It was made in between Silver Linings Playbook, which was their first film together, and American Hustle, which was the more recent one. It was actually made in between those two films, and it's just sort of sat on a shelf gathering dust in that time. The reason being that it's kind of a hard sell. To care about this film, you have to be fairly interested in the American lumber industry during the Depression era.
I'm fascinated by the American lumber industry during the Depression era, so that's just as well.
There we go.
When you say kind of a hard sell, is that a polite euphemism for totally blows?
It doesn't totally blow, but it's a struggle to kind of get into this film. It's just rather dry. Basically, the two of them get hitched, are trying to kind of make ends meet in that era. It's tough. They have to make some very tough decisions. They have a private tragedy. Everything goes a bit nuts. It becomes very kind of heavy duty, tragic territory. It's from Susanna Beer, the director of films like In a Better World and Open Hearts and Brothers. She tends to deal in kind of heavy duty melodrama. And there's not much kind of like lightness of touch to kind of keep you interested in this saga, I don't think.
So basically what we have is good-looking people have a rotten time running a lumberyard in the Depression.
Yeah, it's a little bit like one of those films by James Gray, the guy who made The Yards and We Own the Night, in that it's period, it's grim, it's about America and American struggle, but it doesn't kind of tip you over into really kind of, to be honest, caring enough to kind of to pull you through the story. I think both of them are fine. I actually think Jennifer Lawrence does quite well in period. She can kind of do the kind of glamour girl from that era pretty well. There's this dodgy thing with the gender politics, though. I mean, essentially, this is a little bit of a spoiler, but she loses a child. She has a miscarriage. And from then on in the film, she kind of becomes crazy as a result of this, and psychopathically so, which I think is sort of pressing some fairly odd buttons, actually.
Well, let's hear a clip of it and see if we can persuade our listeners to care.
I never thought I'd find you. I never thought I'd find anyone. How much is yours?
Ours.
I sure would like to know what you think of our little operation.
I think you've taken 9 months to do about 6 months' work.
Did you find a wife or apartment?
Both. I'm afraid your stocks are no longer sufficient collateral.
Sounds dreadful. That's Serena.
Yeah, that's Serena. You might tolerate it if it was like the pilot of a Deadwood-like TV series, and you might kind of bear with it and think, well, it's going to improve. But unfortunately, it just stops, and then that's it. You're done. You're done with it. It's not going to improve. It's finished.
So it kind of reaches a plateau of the good-looking people having a rotten time in the lumberyard in the Depression, and you realize this is all that's going to happen.
Well, more happens, but it's pretty predictable what happens. So yeah, not the best.
Okay. Well, let's move along then, or let's actually, we're not moving along. We are moving backwards. This is Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and this is the this has been remade at least once, hasn't it? I'm not making this
several
up.
Times. Yeah, there was a really good 70s remake with Donald Sutherland. And there was one in the 90s that Abel Ferrara made. This is the 1956 one, the original. It's being reissued. It's been restored. And it's being reissued because the BFI have got a big sci-fi season coming up, and this is the kind of one of the first films that they're kind of putting out again. It's really good to revisit this one, I must say, because it's the one that was made in the kind of in the 50s, and it's a heavy parable about, you know, fear of commies basically in America. So, you know, all of these this town who suspect that everyone's being taken over by these doppelgangers, the paranoia kind of rises and rises. And it really holds up, I think. It's one of those B movies that was made with so much kind of care and craft and skill that it kind of has stood the test of time, and I think feels like an A movie now, really.
Does it actually hold up in its own right, though, or just as a kind of kitsch period piece? Because almost nothing I can think of in cinema dates as quickly and badly as science fiction. Once you start to see sort of 1950s, you know, silver dishes held up with wires versus the modern CGI miracles that can be wrought now.
I know what you mean. The thing is that the effects in this film are done really kind of quite organically. There's not too much of them, and they're quite kind of vegetal. It's all the pods in which, you know, kind of people are being grown in these pods, and it's all kind of gloopy and slimy, and you don't quite know what they use to do it, but it still works. And it's not shiny things being held up with wires. There's really very little of that at all. And you don't have kind of weird aliens with their kind of slanty eyes. There's none of that. It's basically just people looking like other people, but lacking the kind of human emotion that would kind of like signal that this was your uncle or whoever it is.
So it's no Plan 9 from outer space.
It's not, and it doesn't really have that kitsch thing. I mean, the paranoia reaches a sort of pitch, which is kind of slightly comical, I think. But it actually still really works as a suspense movie.
Well,
I mean,
argue that America's actual paranoia against communism at the time reached a pitch which was kind of comical.
Exactly, and the thing about this film that's so interesting is that you can read it from both sides of that. Of that kind of argument, if you like, in that, you know, yes, it's about this kind of weird situation in which half of America seemed to think that the other half of America was being taken over by kind of crazy people with no emotions or souls. But it's also about the hysteria of that and the kind of science fictional kind of delusion of that. So, you know, it's totally readable from both angles. I think it holds up really well.
Okay, well, let's move along to Nightcrawler, in which, in an audacious piece of casting, Jake Gyllenhaal appears as a sort of creepy nocturnal weirdo.
Yes, he is a creepy nocturnal weirdo. That sums him up perfectly. This is about the kind of gutter press. It's about tabloid journalism in LA, and he is the worst of the worst, the lowest of the low of the low. He's the absolute kind of bottom feeding. Goes to crime scenes to kind of like pruriently take footage of people wounded on the street, and then sells these things to the nightly news.
Okay, we have a clip of this. This is Nightcrawler.
We're first! Go around! Get a shot inside the car! Hey, back away!
I got it! I'm back!
Will this be on television?
911, what's your emergency?
We want all of this!
I think Lou is inspiring all of us to reach a little higher.
It's from Nightcrawler. Now, a lot of people are already going to be hearing echoes of both the film and the book versions of James Ellroy's Underworld USA trilogy. Is it in that vein?
That's true, and also quite a lot of Network, actually, as a kind
really?
Of satire. Yeah, absolutely, as a satire on like how low the media can stoop in their desire for ratings and popularity. I mean, however bad you can assume that nightly American news is on the kind of local networks, this film pushes it to that level. It's really awful. It's kind of morally awful. But the thing is that there's no real surprise to it. I found it very compelling. It kind of works as a thriller. But basically, once you realize what it's saying, it's just hammering away at that same point right the way through. And well, though he is cast, Jake Gyllenhaal, he's kind of hammering away at this character without being able to develop him particularly as well.
I'm quite tempted by that. I loved Network. That's Nightcrawler, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, the final choice of our guest film critic Tim Robey. And that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks to our earlier guests, Ivor Gaber and Martin Plout. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Max Koshik, and our studio manager was Chris Grimes. After the headlines, you can hear our food and drink show, The Menu, presented by Marcus Hippie at 2200 The Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Peter Cardwell. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. But for this edition, I'm Andrew Muller. I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.